Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm the CEO and president of the East-West Institute in New York. Welcome to another episode of the EWI podcast, a platform where we explore some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming a good friend and an expert on Asian and world affairs, Kishore Mahbubani. Kishore, welcome to the EWI podcast.
I'm happy to be with you.
Kishore is a 33-year veteran of Singapore's diplomatic service, including having served as the permanent representative to the United Nations and as president of the United Nations Security Council. He is currently professor in the practice of public policy at the National University of Singapore. He is also the author of a recent book titled, Has the West Lost It? A Provocation, and which is really the starting point of our conversation today, beginning with Asia, but also talking about the West and indeed the rest of the world. And Kishore, maybe what we could say is, I would imagine that you've said the West has lost it, but if you listen to me, I can help you find it again. How would you characterize the approach you're taking?
Well, actually, you know, the answer to the question, has the West lost it, is no, or more accurately, not yet. But I think the West is on the way to losing it unless it changes course and understands the nature of the times that we live in. Because unfortunately for the West, they've sort of taken it as a historical norm that the past 200 years of Western domination of world history is the norm for human history. But actually, if you look at the past 200 years of world history against the backdrop of the past 2,000 years, the past 200 years have been a major historical aberration, because from the year 1 to the year 1820, the two largest economies of the world were always those of China and India. So it's perfectly natural by 2020 to see the return of China and India as the biggest economies in the world. But the West is not preparing itself for a world which it can no longer dominate. And that's the core of the problem for the West.
It's a key issue, and it's an issue which is more than a policy issue. It's a conceptual issue. Indeed, it's almost a philosophical issue. And I'm reminded of the historiography of the West, which, if you think of the question of, you know, Kuhn and the paradigm shifts of the way people think, it's the people who feel they were most successful in a certain era who are least capable of adapting to a new one. And so I wonder, before we get into kind of policy issues, how do you think that the narrative that the West has about the naturalness of its rise? I mean, if you know quite well that, you know, if you take a course at a university in the United States, very often it will be the rise of the West or the rise of the Western dominance, as if this is in some cases an inexorable kind of process. How does one, as an interested observer and critic, help the leadership of the West come up with a new narrative?
Well, I think the first thing to hoist on board is to realize that the rise of the West, especially in the last 200 years, is a somewhat unnatural phenomenon. It's an aberration in terms of the longer history of the world. So it was somewhat unusual that you have a very small corner of the world in Europe and then in a new continent in North America sort of dominating the world for 200 years, when the West altogether makes up only 12% of the world's population. Now, this could only happen because 88% of the world's population went to sleep for 200 years. But the populations that went to sleep, especially China and India, happened to wake up in the last 20 or 30 years. And one of the things that future historians will notice is that the West decided to go to sleep around 1990 at the end of the Cold War because, as you know, the West felt triumphant. It felt it defeated the Soviet Union without firing a shot. And therefore, to quote Francis Fukuyama, the West thought it had reached the end of history and therefore it could go to sleep and coast while the rest of the world struggled. And unfortunately, the timing of Francis Fukuyama's essay was rather unfortunate because, as I say in my book, that essay did a lot of brain damage to the West, because it made the West completely unaware of the fact that long dormant civilizations were waking up at precisely the moment when the West was going to sleep. So this major fact of history is something that every Western policymaker should be aware of, because what the West now has to do is that the time has now come for the West to make structural adjustments to a world it can no longer dominate or control.
Now, in your mind, what would be some of these structural adjustments? That is, we're talking about really two things. One is an attitude adjustment, an understanding of what you've just outlined. But would there be concrete things that they need to do in order to adjust? And this also against the backdrop of the problem that it's not just that the large economies, you know, were asleep and woke up, but they also had the experience of the last 200 years of colonialism. So not only is there the issue of the changes that have to take place in the West, but there's also the legacy of what happened over the last 200 years. What should Western leaders, how should they cope with this?
Well, first of all, let me begin with the good news. As you know, the Western colonial record was not great. A lot of people suffered around the world. But the good news is that most of the rest of the world has overcome the colonial past. And there's absolutely no desire for revenge or retribution against the West for what happened in the colonial past. That's all history, and history will take care of history. But for the future, and that's what we need to focus on, not the past, but the future, then the West has got to wake up and realize that its insistence on dominating global institutions long past the sell-by date is very dangerous. And to give two obvious examples, ever since the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank were founded, there's been a rule that says to become the head of the World Bank, you must be an American, and to become the head of the IMF, you must be European. And guess what? 88% of the world's population don't qualify to run these institutions. And even though the most dynamic economies in the world are in Asia, no Asian can run these two institutions. Now, that's the kind of insistence on hanging on to previous, what I call, feudal privileges. That's going to be the problem for the West to deal with in a new era where it can no longer dominate the world.
So in a way, there are two people who are helping this process along. One would be Mr. Xi Jinping when he puts together his own version of an investment bank out of Beijing. But in an ironic way, maybe another person helping this on is Donald Trump, who is in many ways saying or implying through his policies that the so-called liberal world order that we've had since the 1940s needs to be reassessed. So perhaps what you're calling for, even if it's not conscious in the way that you're looking for it, maybe it's happening. What do you think?
Well, I think that the power shift is definitely happening. And as you know, to give you one simple statistic, in 1980, in purchasing power parity terms, the United States share of the global GNP was 25%, and China's share was 2.2%. Which means that China's share in 1980 was less than 10% that of United States. But by 2014, in a major transition that no one paid attention to, China's share of the global GNP became larger than that of the United States, and no one paid attention to it. And that's also part of the problem, because as you know, in America today, even though it's inevitable that even in nominal terms, America will become the number two economy. It's suicidal for any American politician to talk of America becoming number two. And that's the largest structural adjustment that has to happen, the mindset. Now, in the case of Xi Jinping, I would say, certainly if you compare Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, I would say the big difference between the two leaders is that Xi Jinping always takes the long view. He's trying to figure out where China will be 10, 20, 30 years down the road and work towards achieving that goal. By contrast, as you know, Donald Trump seems to work against the next news cycle, sending out a tweet that will sort of get a lot of media attention, but with no consistent long-term strategy. And it's such a tragedy that at a time when the United States should have a very serious president who thinks long-term about how to manage this tremendous historical moment that is coming. You have a president who I suspect is the least well-equipped to handle this major historical transition.
So let's assume that we look to our friends in Singapore, and there is a 33-year veteran of Singaporean diplomacy, and America decides to make him president. And so you are president of the United States. Let's say if you were there, what would be the kind of institutional things that America really could do, the kind of adjustments it could make, in addition, I think, to the more difficult ones, which are psychological? Are there institutional changes America could make?
Fortunately, the good news from my book, Has the West Lost It, is that there is a very simple solution to all the problems we've been speaking about. And this simple solution, as I say in my book, was suggested by a former American president, Bill Clinton. And in a speech in Yale in 2003, he just said very simply, he said, if America can be number one forever, then fine. We can keep on doing what we are doing. We don't have to make any adjustments. Then he added a but. Bill Clinton said, but if we can conceive of a world where we are no longer number one, then surely it is in America's interest to strengthen multilateral rules and partnerships that will then constrain the next number one. So the one simple, actually, switch in policy that America has to do is to switch from undermining multilateral institutions, whether it's the United Nations, the World Trade Organization, or the IAEA. It should switch from undermining multilateral institutions to strengthening multilateral institutions. Because what Bill Clinton was saying is that if you want to live in a world where China respects the global-based rules order, the time for America to show China how to respect the global rules-based order is now, while America is still number one. And that's why, that's a simple piece of advice I would give. You don't have to reinvent the world. Look at the current multilateral architecture that we have. Work to strengthen it and not undermine it.
Now, if we look at this from the point of view of leadership in Beijing or perhaps in Delhi, you could say, well, you know, really, this liberal world order we've had since the late 80s with Bretton Woods institutions, the structure of the UN, the language that was created to create the UN, some people point to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, etc., that this is actually a construct of the West, and it might be tempting for leadership in India or in China, not so much to strengthen existing multilateral institutions, but it might be interesting for them to replace them. What do you think? Do you think there will be a trend in that way?
Well, I mean, this is where I have good news for the West. You know, that China and India and many in the rest of the world, in fact, my book, Has the West Lost It, pays a lot of tribute to the West, because it is, say, that it is the gifts of Western civilization, including the gift of reasoning, the gift of global governance institutions, that has made our world into such a wonderful place today. Because most people, as you know, the West is drowning in pessimism. And many in the West are not aware that in terms of the human condition, it has never been better as it has been in the past 30 years. Wars are diminishing. Global poverty, when you had a situation in 1950, three-quarters of the world's population were suffering from extreme poverty. Today is less than 10%. And China and India are among the biggest beneficiaries of this Western rules-based order that has been created. So actually, it is in the interest of China and India to preserve this rules-based order, because especially if we take an organization like WTO, they are the biggest beneficiaries of it. Of course, some institutions have to make adjustments. For example, the UN Security Council, it is absurd that you have UK and France, yesterday's powers, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, when tomorrow's power, India, is not on it. So there have to be some structural adjustments that have to be made. The European overrepresentation in key multilateral institutions has to be reduced, but I think that can be done. And when it's done, India and China will accept most of the current rules-based architecture because they are now becoming the biggest beneficiaries of this rules-based architecture.
Do you think that if that were to happen, and I think that's not out of the realm of possibility, that the attitude that India and China might take towards multilateralism might change as well? The reason I say this is that in my experience working here at this nonprofit or in my previous life as a diplomat, I found that the assumptions that many Chinese diplomats would make very often were that when they were in multilateral settings, and I'm not saying the UN, but let's say with a number of states, they were extremely skeptical about the notion of having alliances. They would say alliances are aimed against people. They are not positive things. Similarly, India has sometimes strained relations with its immediate neighbors, even as it works with them closely. So do you think that the attitude towards multilateralism will also change over time in India and China? They'll become more comfortable in working not so much one-on-one, but in multilateral situations?
Well, the answer to the question will depend a lot on what America does in the next 20, 30 years. And so if America works to strengthen the global institutions and then shows that it actually is good for the world, then China and India may try and copy what America is doing. But if America continues doing what it is doing now, which is trying to wreck many global multilateral institutions, then it is basically setting a bad example for China and India. But here, if I want to balance that with some good news, I would say that anybody who wants to understand how China views the global multilateral order, they should read the two speeches that Xi Jinping gave in Davos and Geneva in January 2017. And they're remarkable speeches. And they say exactly the opposite of what Donald Trump or John Bolton would say. They actually say, hey, we have a good rules-based order in the UN, the World Trade Organization. Let's strengthen them and not undermine them. So the fact that China is still committed to strengthening global multilateral institutions is a huge gift for the world that we shouldn't take for granted. But if their efforts to do this are rebuffed and America starts to take down these institutions, and if you destroy the WTO, then you may leave China with no choice but to take a unilateral road. And if China and India take a unilateral road, that's very bad for the world.
I would agree with that. And it's interesting to think of two kind of initiatives that are going on right now. And I'm curious how you evaluate them. One would be what we could call the Indo-Pacific approach that the Americans have, that in some ways is part of Indian thinking, where there's a tendency, for example, for countries like America, Japan, Australia, India to think about common interests. And of course, the very famous one, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is another innovative way of looking at multilateral cooperation. What do you make of these two approaches?
I think, you know, one doesn't have to be a geopolitical genius to predict that in the next 10 years, when China's GNP, even in nominal terms, becomes bigger than the United States, there'll be a lot of discomfort in the United States about becoming number two, and competition, geopolitical competition between the United States and China will step up. And here, of course, as the United States looks for allies to balance China, only one country has a population as large as China, and that is India. So it's perfectly natural for United States to reach out to India and say, can we work together to balance China? But of course, the approach that you take is very important because India will not become a subservient ally like Japan or the United Kingdom. And one of the mistakes that the Americans make in dealing with India is that they often don't treat India with enough respect. And when the Indians don't get treated with respect, they say, okay, we'll show you how independent we can be. So it's very important that if America wants to cultivate India, the first thing it has to do is treat India with respect. And of course, the Chinese are, of course, trying to counterbalance any American effort to encircle China by sharing China's prosperity with all its neighbors. And that's what the Belt and Road Initiative is all about. So in theory, the Indo-Pacific initiative is a trade and economic initiative. In theory, the Belt and Road Initiative is an economic initiative, but they're both driven by strong geopolitical impulses. Fortunately, if you play the economic game, it's not a zero-sum game. So, for example, if the Belt and Road Initiative succeeds and China's neighbors do well, they can actually create markets for American products. For example, Boeing now sells more planes in China than it does in America.
We talk as if there are these three nodes. There's America, there's Beijing, there's Delhi. What about Europe? In many cases, Europe is undergoing psychological changes that are related to, but not entirely the same as the United States. It has the legacy of being the world colonial power, the origin of many of the ideas that you have said are some of the good news, some of the traditions that have been good for the world. Do you see Europe as playing a new and renewed role or a different role as an elder statesman in a new and revived or changed world?
I would very much like Europe to play a bigger role on the world stage because in my book, one of the big recommendations, as I indicated earlier, is that we should promote more multilateralism. And the multilateral giant of the world, of course, is the European Union. And the European Union should be providing the leadership for creating a more multilateral global order. Unfortunately, the tragedy about the European Union is that it is an economic giant but a geopolitical dwarf, because the European leaders spend more time negotiating their internal arrangements than dealing with the external world. And the best analogy I can think of is about the people rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic just as it is about to go down. So that's an absolutely crazy aspect of the European Union. When the leaders meet, they're so busy haggling with each other, and certainly now all they're obsessed about is Brexit. And Brexit is a great distraction at a time when the Europeans need to make other fundamental structural adjustments, because I can tell you very clearly what the big geopolitical challenge for Europe is going to be in the long run. And this is that in the year 1950, Europe's population was twice that of Africa's. By 2100, Africa's population will be 10 times that of Africa. So if the Europeans don't start exporting jobs to Africa, Africa will start exporting Africans to Europe. And that's already begun, and that's created a huge populist backlash in Europe. And all this could have been, you could have seen this coming, because in 1993, in an essay called The West and the Rest, I said, watch out, the boats are coming from the Mediterranean. And 25 years later, they came. And you could see this coming 25 years ago.
Now, in this case, it's an interesting question about whether or not Europe has the capacity, given those demographic facts, to respond. So two questions I'd have for you is, one, do you see someone like President Macron being the kind of leader who has the vision to pull Europe together? Or the second question I have is this demographic fact of the growth of population in Africa and the disparity of income and of wealth between Africa and Europe, is it reasonable to say that Europe is doomed? That is to say that Europe as it is now simply cannot withstand what will happen?
Well, I think I would say, you know, this. I was in Davos in January 2018 and I heard four leaders speak: Trump, Modi, Merkel, and Macron. And by far the most impressive of these four was Macron, because he spoke in English without any text and he explained simply and clearly how the world needs to adjust and work together in this new world order. And I thought he gave a very brave speech at the United States Congress on multilateralism. And it's quite shocking how few Americans paid attention to the advice that he gave down there. Yes, certainly Macron gives us hope for the future. But I would say that the cause is not lost for Europe. This goes to your second question. Because if you look at it objectively, actually, many African economies are doing well, and I'm actually bullish about the prospects for Africa. And the good news is that China and even India are investing a lot in Africa. So what the European Union needs to do now is to not condemn Chinese investment in Africa. And the Europeans do that because since America condemns Chinese investment in Africa, the Europeans thought that their job is to be good allies and condemn Chinese investment in Africa. But Chinese investment in Africa is a long-term gift to Europe, because if the Chinese create jobs in Africa, then less Africans will go to Europe. So actually there should be an alliance between China and the European Union to develop Africa. And this is the kind of new sort of radical thinking, the kind of structural adjustments that Europe needs to make to deal with the new world that is coming.
Well, let's turn. We've talked about a lot of the major powers in the world. We've talked about China, India, Europe, America. But one of the things about the technological change of the last generation is that, you know, many things have become decentralized. And I think that's one of the elements that defines multilateralism in the 21st century. Let's take an example of a country that has enormous political clout, given the fact that it's small. And indeed, that is Singapore. What about smaller countries and the role that they are going to play? Not everyone can be a Singapore, but what's the role that smaller countries will play in a time of this reallocation of power in a multilateral world?
Well, I'm also, you know, you'll find that in my writings, I tend to be very optimistic. I'm also optimistic for the small states in the world, because if you look at it, in the past, ever since the United Nations Charter was launched in 1945, actually fewer and fewer small states are being invaded and occupied by their larger neighbors. So if you look at the fortunes of small states, they are actually getting better and better as time passes. So there are incredible number of economic opportunities coming in the way of small states who get their policies right. And Singapore, fortunately, is one of them. And Singapore is actually fortunate that, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, everyone dismissed Southeast Asia as the Balkans of Asia, where you would see endless conflict. And instead, Southeast Asia has, incredibly enough, even though it's the most diverse corner of planet Earth, has now become one of the most peaceful corners of planet Earth. And ASEAN, which used to be a group of poor countries, already has the seventh largest economy in the world, and well on its way to becoming the fourth largest economy in the world in 10 years. Now, that provides tremendous opportunities for small states like Singapore. So if you're a smart, savvy investor, you would be investing your money in this region.
And will those countries, do you think, will the multilateral institutions of ASEAN, with Singapore as one of its leading powers, will they be able to give their gifts to the world? One thinks of ASEAN at this point as a regional organization. Do you think it will become one that has a global influence and a global vision?
Well, actually, it's quite amazing how much ASEAN has been doing. As you know, there have been troubles from time to time between China and India. There have been troubles from time to time between China and Japan. And if they get into a squabble about World War II or a squabble about the islands that they're disputing, the leaders cannot meet. They got to find a way to break the ice. And you know what? The one place where they can go to break their ice is at the annual ASEAN meetings. So if you look at the one place where all the great powers come together every year to talk to each other, it's either at the ASEAN ministerial meetings or at the ASEAN summit. So the East Asian summit, which has the 10 ASEAN countries, and then you have China, Japan, Korea, India, Australia, New Zealand, and United States and Russia, is now emerged as one of the most important gatherings for global leaders to come together. And that's a gift from ASEAN to the world.
That's very impressive. And it's interesting to think then that we're not only seeing a reallocation of power among the great states, but that the whole notion of how states work with one another will be a dynamic process that you write about. And, you know, summing up in your book, do you also address the question of non-state power? That is, do you still also think of the fact that there are some issues that cross international boundaries, like climate change, issues like proliferation, that perhaps states themselves, a Westphalian model of states, is not enough? What do you think of the future of that? You know, we as a small nonprofit think of ourselves as that part of diplomacy, something not tied to states but addressing bigger issues. How do you feel about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, well, the way the world is changing, see, what's happening is that there are many structural changes happening in the world, and one major structural change that is being carried out by technology is that technology is shrinking the world in every dimension. So that's why today you have all kinds of global crises, from global financial crisis of 2007-2008 to global warming, from global terrorism to global pandemics. So the world has changed structurally. So in the past, when you look at the old world order, when you saw 7 billion people living in 193 separate countries, it was as though they were living in 193 separate boats. But today, the 7 billion people of the world no longer live in 193 separate boats. They live on 193 separate cabins on the same boat. The problem with our global boat is that you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin, but no captain or crew taking care of the global boat as a whole. And that's why we need to strengthen the global multilateral institutions to take care of this new wave of challenges that you just spoke about, Cameron, that we have to deal with, especially global warming. And no country can solve global warming on its own. We all have to come together. And this is a real test of the intelligence of the human species, because if we as human species destroy the only planet we have, planet Earth, there's no planet B to go to. So clearly, we have to wake up and deal with these issues now, and from a non-national perspective, and deal with them from a new global perspective.
Well, I like very much your use of the metaphor of ships. Now, you used one, which was the deck chairs on the Titanic, and one which was the cabins on the big ship. And I choose to think of that big, nice ocean liner peacefully going through the world's oceans rather than all of us heading for an iceberg. So I will choose to be optimistic as well. So thank you for the insights that you've had. And before we close the show, I'd like to again thank Kishore Mahbubani for joining us and sharing his insights on the rise of Asia, what it means for the rest of the region, what it means for the West, and how the institutions of multilateralism will change, and especially the message he has in his book, that the West may have lost it or may be losing it, but that it's not too late, that in fact multilateralism may be the way out. Kishore, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, once again, Kishore's new book is called Has the West Lost It? A Provocation. I highly recommend picking it up. And remember to look for the EWI podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East-West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations.